Hey, gang. Dave Marcus, New York correspondent for The Federalist here. I'm joined today for the Federalist Radio Hour with by Abe Greenwald, who is executive editor at Commentary, and we're going to have a couple things to discuss today. Thanks for being here, Abe.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
So the first issue I want to get into is this question of statues and monuments that's really been at the forefront over the past couple of weeks. Several weeks ago, I want to say it was two or three, you guys ran a really excellent editorial addressing this issue and what you thought it kind of really meant. Can you just break that down a little bit, like where you guys landed on what you thought was beginning to happen there?
The funny thing about the editorial, which is actually, it's in our July-August issue, but it went online, about 2-3 weeks ago. But it's still up on the commentarymagazine.com website, and it's called We Must Stop the Great Unraveling. The funny thing about that is that that was written before the statue issue really got going. So statues themselves are actually not mentioned in it, but it is all certainly part of the same picture. That was written in response to the riots in cities across the country, the online mobs and the scalp hunts and the cancel culture. I mean, the physical dimension of the rioting and the tearing down of statues is very much of a piece with the online mobs and the mobs in media and journalism. It's where it's mob mentality all told. And the piece was really about how this has to stop, not only because it's extraordinarily unpleasant and deadly, by the way. I mean, the rioting killed, I don't know what the tally is at this point, but numerous people did of course untold damage. It's not only extraordinarily unpleasant, but it is a danger to the American way of life, and that is its goal. Its goal is to upend the American way of life and to upend the American experiment as we know and love it, and replace it with something else.
So let's go from there to Trump's July 3rd speech, the dark and divisive one that he delivered at Mount Rushmore. Right. I had a take on that I'm curious to see what you think about, because it's one that some people who I respect and often agree with sort of disagreed with me on. And that is, I believe that Trump's very full-throated endorsement of the founders and of monuments and all of these things reset the table in a way, because for 2 weeks you had all kinds of outlets and people having legitimate discussions about Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt and these other things. And when he delivered this speech, the media reaction to it, instead of addressing that full-throated defense of the founders, they ignored that completely and just invented a speech about Confederate statues that they wrote about instead. That felt like a retreat. I think it was Carol Markowitz who was responding to Abby Phillips or someone on Twitter who had said, you know, oh, well, mostly this is about the Confederate statues. And Carol was like, no. You don't get to go back. Like, that boat has sailed, it's burned, and it's sunk. So, I mean, what do you think about that and just of the speech in general and the role it plays?
I thought the speech was okay. I didn't love it as much as some people did. Although I liked it in parts a great deal, not least because it had some, I think, sort of weirdly kitschy elements that I thought were kind of interesting. Sort of tying in the grandeur of America, you know, mixing in the founders and Martin Luther King with the vision to build Las Vegas. And things of that nature. When he talked about the style of Frank Sinatra, things like that. Well, all of which, by the way, I appreciated. And of course, I supported its full-throated endorsement of American ideals and the American founding and the rest of it. Did it reset the stage? That was the intention. I don't know that that is ultimately what happened. I mean, I think the response to it on the left, which is, as you say, to have made up an entirely different speech and attack that, I don't know that's so much of a retreat as it is just a continuation of their offensive play. They're just trying to bury him with everything they can.
But why not in that case? Like why weren't they able to actually attack what he said? Is it because they actually agree with that, or is it because why couldn't they say that?
I mean, I think to the extent that he did defend patriotism and American ideals, they don't agree. That is already in. When I say they, I mean the sort of, you know, the hard left. That's, you know, the mob, the sort of the mind behind the mob. For them, that is divisive, right? Because we're now at a point in the conversation. Not that it's a conversation, but in the harangue, where to believe in America's ideals is to believe in something that is misguided, racist in its inception, and racist forever. So they didn't agree with it. But because the logic of that position is so faulty, they did need to muster up some additional evidence that wasn't there for its divisiveness.
So, you know, in terms of this asymmetrical conversation, which you rightly say is not a conversation, but a lecture, do you think some of the fault for that situation is that the left takes a much more aggressive stance in terms of attacking right-wing positions on things like racism, what America is, equal opportunities, stuff like that, than conservatives do to the other side? Basically, there's some couching, there's some apologizing. Like, I imagine Mitt Romney or even Marco Rubio giving that speech and there being a lot more about, we need to tackle the troubling racist past of the United States. Do you think conservatives over the past years have conceded a little too much on this issue and aren't in a great position to fight back now?
The truth is, I'm not sure. I know a lot of people do feel that way and recognize in Trump the sort of the end of the semi-apology and the mealy-mouthed statement of national ideals. But if that's the case, you have to take into account that Trump, although not apologizing for things that we shouldn't be apologizing for, also is not the best messenger in defense of the things we should be defending. Mm-hmm. He will do it, and we should be thankful to some degree for that. But he also gets the message wrong frequently,
right?
And often when he goes off script and adds his own embellishments.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's often things that you know, like tying that message into sending people to jail for flag burning doesn't make an enormous amount of sense, for example.
Precisely.
Especially if you're then going to turn around and talk about the Confederate flag. I mean, that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, in fact, it makes it harder on those of us who do want to give the best defense for the great things about this country.
Yeah.
But I don't know that conservatives have been too apologetic in the past. It certainly didn't feel terribly apologetic at the time, right? Mm-hmm. That's kind of a hindsight assessment that I'm not sure those who are criticizing Romney and Rubio for what they've said, and, you know, I don't know, between 2008 and 2016, I don't know that they had the same criticisms of them then.
But were we operating under an assumption for much of that time that the left meant it when they said there were limiting principles to all of these things? And that when we started talking about slippery slopes, whether it was statues of Thomas Jefferson or you know, what we're teaching fifth graders about America and race and everything else, that we were operating under the assumption that at some point cooler heads were going to prevail and the crazy, crazy, crazy stuff wasn't going to happen. Now we're watching video like that woman on the Community Education Council screaming at a guy for, you know, having a friend with a black kid. I mean, it's insane. And there doesn't seem to be the guardrail that I guess I kind of assumed existed.
I think back then, in the halcyon days of, you know, 5 years ago, there were both a sane liberal left or a saner liberal left and a revolutionary left, and there was a sense among the less revolutionary members of the liberal class that there should be guardrails, and that there were guardrails, and that there were limiting principles. What has happened is that they've been eaten entirely, eaten up by the revolutionary left. So I don't know that we were wrong to be cognizant of a saner approach then, but it is almost no longer operable today. I mean, there are some figures who I'm certain don't believe in the most radical revolutionary aspects of social justice, but nevertheless, either pay it lip service or sort of avoid the hard questions for fear of alienating those on their left flank today.
Yeah, yeah. Lest they become Elliot Engel, I suppose.
That's right.
Yeah. Computer systems in cars are the new normal. From electronically controlled transmissions to touchscreen displays to dozens of sensors, but you can't fix any of these new features yourself. So when something breaks, it could cost a fortune. And now is not the time for expensive repairs. I remember when my car broke down trying to get out of a ball game not too long ago, and I'll tell you, the expenses were pretty steep. And that's why I have CarShield. CarShield has affordable protection plans that can save you thousands for a covered repair, including computers, GPS, electronics, and more. The people at CarShield understand payment flexibility is an absolute must. Monthly plans can be customized to your needs with rates as low as $99 a month. No long-term contracts or commitments. CarShield gives you options others won't. You get to choose your favorite mechanic or dealership to do the work, and CarShield takes care of the rest. They also offer complimentary 24/7 roadside assistance and a rental car while yours is being fixed. CarShield has helped over 1 million customers. So drive with confidence, knowing you've got coverage from America's number one auto protection company. For as low as $99 a month, you can protect yourself from surprises and save thousands for a covered repair. Call 800-CAR-6000 and mention the code Federalist, or visit carshield.com and use code Federalist to save 10%. That's carshield.com, code Federalist. A deductible may apply. All right, so let's shift gears just a little bit and move over to the COVID crisis that's ongoing and seems to show no signs of abating anytime soon. We're in a curious position now where we're seeing a huge uptick in cases, much of which has to do with doing more testing, also may very well just be more people getting it. We're also seeing far fewer deaths, and that overall mortality rate just sort of gets lower and lower and lower. Let me put the question this way, and this may sound cynical, but if Hillary Clinton was president today and we were in roughly the same situation, in what ways do you think this story would be told a little differently? I mean, do you think that it would be?
I think it would be told entirely differently. And I'm pulling up now a headline that speaks to this point that I came across today that was absolutely astounding. This is from Bloomberg News today. The headline reads, "A lower COVID-19 death rate is nothing to celebrate."
Nice.
Really? Really? If that is nothing to celebrate in the midst of the worst public health catastrophe by liberals' own lights, the worst public health catastrophe to befall us in a century, where with the economy shut down and having, as a New Yorker, having gone through just the daily punishing, dispiriting, rising death tolls. it's nothing to celebrate that a lower COVID-19 death toll. If we can't celebrate that, then there is absolutely nothing to celebrate ever.
Are we not supposed to celebrate it because like that will then we'll feel like it's over and stop taking? I mean, why? What's the reason that we can't celebrate it? Will it make us not cautious enough?
I think some of it is pure fear, and I think that's the more generous explanation for this. That there are people who are genuinely certain that it's laying in wait, and the rising death toll is coming again. And it's going to overtake the country like nothing we've ever seen. There's going to be not one New York, but five New Yorks. And it's just a matter of time. And then on the other hand, there is this sense that because Donald Trump and other conservatives, but mainly Trump, have expressed some sense of optimism, some urgency about moving forward and getting out of this and looking beyond it, that doing anything at all like that is bad, and that the moral obligation is to live in this as long as possible.
So is that, I mean, to what extent does this then start to frame the election? We already may end up with this bizarre situation where the Democratic National Convention is some sort of like online or television only event. Which, I mean, at least they have a lot of producing talent on the left. So, I mean, they might be able to come up with, you know, something right. compelling. And, you know, a big, normal Republican National Convention for the Republicans. Meanwhile, just a couple minutes ago in his press conference, Cuomo took a swipe at President Trump for saying that schools should be open because New York City just announced that they'll only have, like, I think 1 to 3 days a week of school. Right. So that quite possibly works its way in as an election issue. To what extent does the election now start to become a battle between those who think there needs to be a new normal and those who want to go back to the way things were?
I mean, I think there's quite a lot of that. And the politicization of the pandemic generally is completely dominates the news now. And the funny thing about Cuomo and other liberals and is that, and Cuomo himself said this a few days ago, I just follow the science. I'm just interested in the science. It's the guys on the right. It's the crazy conservatives who have politicized this. As Cuomo said, how you politicize a pandemic, I don't know. And that's great. Me, I'm just following the science. But of course, they're not at all. You know, they discard, for example, the lowering death rate.
Right.
And things of that nature. It is definitely going to shape the election. It is now the primary issue in the country. And it's also going to shape the election, not just in terms of there are those who want to live in some version of lockdown and those who want to move past it. But there's been a problem for Trump, I think. And I say this as someone who thinks he was very unfairly lambasted for the way he responded to the pandemic early on. I don't think he did much that was terribly wrong. In fact, I think he did more or less most of what he could do at the time. But the problem that he's created for himself now is that he seems to have checked out of the issue entirely. It's one thing to want to move on. I share that with him. It's one thing to recognize the urgency of restarting the economy, getting America out and working again, getting people out of their homes, so to mitigate the additional public health crisis that has been imposed on us from the lockdown, but he's sort of not paying attention to things, or at least that is the sense. And I kind of feel I trace that back sort of to when there was a period when he was giving the daily COVID task force briefings on TV, and they were heavily criticized, but I think they did some good and some bad, but definitely some good in there. And he's sort of, very uniquely for him, he got kind of beaten into stopping those. And it seems as if at that point he said, okay, you don't want me involved in this. I'm checked out. I'm done with this.
There was an event that there was a gaffe, right? Like 2 days before, I mean, this all feels like it was 15 years ago now, mm-hmm. but I feel like there was a gaffe that kind of like triggered that and kind of, I mean, you're right that there had been criticism of it growing. But yeah, I agree with you that those were a mixed bag, but I think that's Trump just in general, right? Like it's a package deal. So you can't get that, you know, Queen's bombacity and swagger with, you know, with the modesty of Mike Pence. Like it doesn't happen. When that's your attitude, you're going to say big, huge things. You're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're not going to walk it back. And I mean, that's Donald that's Trump's right. whole life.
Right. And it has worked for him as much as it's hurt too, you know?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I think that's right.
Know, it's worked for him in that sometimes he makes his enemies so crazy that they can't see straight and they sort of miss their opportunities.
It's amazing how often it seems like his fiercest critics wind up behaving just like him. Even going back to that brief time when Rubio in 2016 thought he was going to be Don Rickles, started like, it was ridiculous, right? But he really does. Like everybody ends up down in the mud with him, just kind of amazing. But I
think it is, it's one thing to want to move on and he's right about that. But there's, for example, his musings on the potential drawbacks of testing, you know, that's not good. That sparks a debate, not about should we move on or stay locked down, but about, well, what is the nature of who's in charge right now?
Yeah.
You know, and that,
no, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. And, you know, I think there's a way to say, hey, listen, we're doing so much testing now that these numbers are really going to go up. But here's what you need to know about that. That's mm-hmm. different than saying this testing's going to make me and my administration look bad. So like,
right.
That's not the way to say that.
And there's also a way to say, and he struck this tone at some point very briefly, Trump did, and it was good. There's also a way to say, we have to move on, we have to open up gradually, and it is going to cost us in lives, and we're going to try to mitigate that as best we can, but nonetheless, for the sake of the country, we still have to move on. That you can do that without saying the virus is nothing, it's all over. You know, you can say, no, it's not all over, but we must go on with life and be smart.
Yeah. Can Trump accept a half win? Right. I mean, he's not great at it in the past, but maybe he can. So from potential half win to what I think we would both agree is a lose-lose, I wanted to talk in our last segment here about our beloved city of New York and what's going on here. I think for people outside of New York City, it's a little hard to comprehend exactly what's happening here. But the way I wanted to open this discussion is, you know, I realized you and I are around the same age, which means that we're some of the youngest people who have adult memories of the bad old days, or at least teenage, whatever it is, right? We remember what New York City was like in the 1980s and the very early 1990s. And I find, either because my descriptive skills are poor, or because it seems so completely out of touch with what New York City is now, when I try to talk to a 30-year-old about what New York City was like, either they don't believe me or they just can't quite process what it means. I don't know if you've had that experience, but they think it was gritty or something, but like there was real fear. Like, what are your memories of it?
I'll give you a perfect example, because this came up, I think, just last night. I was talking to a friend because I fear this will happen again. I remember Central Park more or less as a no-go zone. You could go to some areas during some points of the day. In the evening, it was absolutely not going to happen. You wouldn't really want to cross the park from east to west or west to east. That was going deep in and opening yourself up to who knows what kind of horrors. It was drug dealers, muggings. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate it, but I mean, people went to the park, but I was also a kid. So for me, it was considered a risk. It wasn't, you went to the park, but you didn't do it with being totally carefree.
No, there were definitely no-go zones. Yeah. I mean, when I got to NYU in 93, we used to have a game that we would play. Now, this wasn't a no-go zone, but we would have a game that we would play when we walked diagonally across Washington Square, where you had to guess how many people would offer to sell you drugs.
Right.
And a modest guess was usually somewhere in the like 12 to 13 range. You know, it could go all the way up to 25. And certainly once you got to certain parts of Alphabet City, you didn't
go. That's right. And now, so what's going on now with de Blasio, with the defunding the police and getting rid of the plainclothes anti-crime units, not only did that result in an immediate massive spike of violent crime and gun violence. I think there were 60 shootings over in New York City over July 4th weekend. But the word is out to every other potential criminal who wants to do something that there is little to no enforcement. This is your time. There's been some shootings that look like personal jobs. And people sort of tend to kind of treat those as anomalous. Well, that's not sort of crime as, you know, something that we need to worry about on a large scale. That was a personal conflict. But that is exactly the kind of thing that happens when there is no enforcement. That is your, if you you want to take your revenge on someone, that's when you do it. You want to get a gun, this is the time to get the gun. That's what the plainclothes units were there to crack down on.
Yeah. Well, and to carry it. So let me ask you this, you know, for 5-6 years now, de Blasio and his allies and the Democrats have been saying, well, look, you know, we got rid of stop, question, and frisk and nothing happened, and similar programs that they got rid of. But isn't it true that there's an extent to which getting rid of stop, question, and frisk was always going to take several years to change the underlying culture? Because the concept really was that when a gang member or somebody involved in crime was leaving the house, they knew that if they just had a gun on their person, there was a decent chance that they were going to get stopped. They were going to get, you know, arrested for having an illegal gun. Maybe they have warrants, you know, whatever it is. Over a period of years, that culture seems to have changed to a point where people feel much more comfortable having the gun on them. And I think it makes a big difference when there's a confrontation, if you've got the gun right now, or if you've got to go run home or run to someplace to get the gun. I mean, is that a fear that you have in regard to New York's current criminal class?
I think that's right. You raise the price for you make it that much harder to engage in that activity. I'm open to the idea that stop and frisk was, first of all, was an extraordinarily effective policy and was a good policy, but that it then became a victim of its own success in that because it was so effective, there did come a time to pull back on. And I think that in and of itself, pulling back on that policy would not produce the disastrous results we're seeing. It is this combination, this perfect storm of that, of an anti-police culture across the board, of defunding, of getting rid of vital units. All of it together has just made the city extraordinarily depressing.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on, especially during the Bloomberg years with regard to stop and frisk. You know, I think Bloomberg skipped whatever day they taught civil liberties in law school, or, you know, business school or whatever.
Right.
But
he doesn't
seem very interested in those. And I guess he's busy with his alleged contact tracer army now.
Remember all that brilliant contact tracing that was supposed to happen?
Yeah, it was going to be transformative. Like everybody was going to have that job. Yeah. And now, like,
so I mean, apparently contact tracing has been bad across the country, but in New York, I know that half the COVID cases that they've tried to trace, they've not traced at all. And that, of course, if you participated in the protests after the killing of George Floyd, you don't have to say where you went.
But I just wonder if these people have ever been to Brooklyn, because you don't show up at somebody's house in Brooklyn and say, I need a list of everyone that you've been around over the last 10 days.
Yes. Yeah.
That doesn't go over well.
No, you could do these things in a place like South Korea where the state can take extra steps to find out where you've been and what, but good luck, you know.
Going back to a point that you were making about the NYPD, and I think this is true across the country now, given that so many local governments very clearly just do not have the back of their police force, that they will not give officers anything close to the benefit of the doubt. In fact, in many cases, much the opposite. Can we really blame police officers who are confronted with what could be a dangerous and difficult situation, who make the decision not to engage because if something goes wrong, it could be their, you know, job, their pension, their freedom? Don't we at least have to give them the option of like maybe waiting for more reinforcements or something if we're going to change the rules regarding their liability?
Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, I certainly cannot. I don't blame them at all. You know, where that leaves us as citizens of a city in crisis is a different matter. But no, you cannot blame them. As you say, the rules were changed. They joined the force with a certain understanding of how they would be supported, and now they're being left out there to hang. You know, and it's worth remembering in all this. The old complaint about police, and not just in New York, but around the country, especially in LA and elsewhere, from the 60s well into the 80s, the complaint about racism, and it was valid, was that police racism was expressed by virtue of the fact that they didn't police minority neighborhoods, right? They didn't care. You can call them, they don't come, they don't care. They don't care what we do to each other. That's right. So that was corrected, and now that we're going to go back to that, or some version of that.
It's amazing to me, though, that in these policy discussions, and I think even a lot of conservatives and Republicans have been open to a lot of these ideas, that in these policy discussions, that other side of the ledger just never even gets mentioned. There's, you know, there's almost this, you know, like we want them to be superhuman or something. I mean, they're literally dealing with chaos. They're literally dealing with something that has no rules, mm-hmm. and they have to do it while abiding by rules, which of course they do, obviously. Mm-hmm. But why aren't our policy leaders understanding that when they create more rules for the police, they also have to give them some kind of other support?
Well, nothing about the discussion has been terribly reasoned from the start, right? The actual data, I mean, and this is, you know, there are people who know this data much, much better than I do, but the actual data on the number of unarmed Black Americans that police kill every year does not speak to a national crisis, does not speak to the need to absolutely revamp every police force in the country. So we've started from such illogical premises that we missed the boat on treating this intelligently the whole way through. I mean, there's never, not for one instant, has this discussion ever been sort of in keeping with real world experience ever.
Do you think that in part has to do that? There's something that I've noticed in big cities. I want to say over the past 10 or 15 years, where there used to be big Democratic Party machines that were sort of like, you know, patron machines, like that they would fill out jobs, you know, they would get people on ballots and do that. And they were very corrupt, right? And there were all these sort of anti-corruption measures to try to like break up their power. But the difference was that with a big Democratic Party machine, there were fewer crazy city council people who said abolish the police. There were fewer crazy people on education boards screaming, you know, bloody racism at everything they see. Do you see any connection between the destruction of the classic Democratic big party machine and the rise of these really out of step progressive wokesters in so much of local government.
Well, not only that, there's a new machine, the Justice Democrats,
right?
And they put a lot of money into fostering and supporting the campaigns of radical Democrats in cities across the country, and prosecutors. There's a good commentary article on this by Andrew McCarthy called, I think it's called the Radical Prosecutor Project, something like that, that from a few months ago. And that has been extraordinarily effective at putting prosecutors in placing prosecutors in cities who don't want to prosecute. And we see the results, we see the fruit of their labors everywhere, every weekend, every week, in every city.
One of them almost won in Queens, right? Very, very close the last time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
AOC-backed
right.
woman yeah. who was running, yeah. It was very narrow. It's amazing to me. I mean, when or if do you think there is going to be blowback about this disconnect? Because it's ridiculous to think that the majority of people in Minneapolis want what the Minneapolis City Council is talking about.
Well, after New York had 60 shootings over the weekend, but Chicago had 80, right? And two little girls were killed there, or maybe yeah. one was killed, I don't remember, over the past weekend. And you can hear the parents and grandparents and the family and the neighbors of these child victims in Chicago. They're out there screaming, and I'm talking about African Americans who are out there screaming, "This is not what I want. This is yeah. I don't. We need police. We don't. What is this lawless horror show that you've plunged us into?" So absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and meanwhile, celebrities with
security
details right. think that this is going to liberate the masses, and aren't they good for supporting it? Mm-hmm. All right, well, Abe, thank you so much for taking some time. Your insights are very valuable to us. And until next time, kids, that's the Federalist Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. Mm-hmm.